Ladies and gentlemen, thank you. If we are about to start, I'd like to welcome our guests this evening. I always say about guests who are well known needs very little introduction. Peter Mandelson, Lord Mandelson, is one of these people who's known as controversial. This is the sort of hyperbole you hear for all sorts of people. I think in this particular case, it's entirely accurate. He was one of, and hopefully we'll do more this evening. He was, of course, one of the founders of New Labour, along with Tony Blair and Gordon Brown. He was one of the architects of the Labour government that lasted for 13 years since 1997, was a participant in that government on no less than two occasions, and then had a third life in Gordon Brown's government. A third life with no less than three titles: First Secretary of State, Lord President of the Council, Secretary of State for Business, Innovation and Skills. He was also, and I hope we can talk about this later, European Trade Commissioner. In that capacity, did a lot of the negotiations with China, which is of particular local interest here. And of course, he was Secretary of State for Northern Ireland during the period of the peace talks. Those are the real titles. The other titles, I'm sure you know more than I about. Prince of Darkness, the real Prime Minister in the last administration. But I think the most important thing from the point of view of members of a press club, and this is a less known thing about Peter Mandelson, is he's born into a newspaper background, brought up on the benefits of a newspaper background. His father was the advertising manager of the Jewish Chronicle in London, so we're always welcome, very welcoming, to somebody who's helped to make money for newspapers. Let me just begin by, the format of this, incidentally, just so everybody knows how we're going to do this, is that there'll be a discussion on stage, and then we'll open it to the floor. And then Peter Mandelson has kindly agreed to do some more book signing afterwards. So it's, you know, it's value for money this evening. Let me start by asking you, why did you write the book?
Well, very good question. I hope that at the end of our encounter this evening, and you go out and buy the book and read it, you will discover why I wrote it. I wrote it in order to provide a mixture of insight, historical account, personal memoir, and entertainment. I wanted to write a book that wasn't a normal minister's memoir of the sort we've seen too many of in the past. You know, I attended this committee meeting, I made this speech, I made this intervention, I took this decision. Aren't I sort of wonderful? I wanted to write a book that was very honest. I don't see any point in going to such lengths in writing a book of this kind without telling people things that they didn't already know. A lot has been said about New Labour, the history of the last 25 years, the Labour Party's near-death experience in the 1980s, the seismic changes that brought New Labour to power in the 1990s. All that we did, and I think achieved, during our period in government over 13 years, we can come back and discuss that if you want, and which brought us to our defeat this year in 2010. People know rather a lot in the internet age, and therefore if they're going to buy a book like this, they're entitled to expect to know more. I wanted also to, give an account of a set of political changes of which I'm proud of having played some part. And I also wanted to tell a story about myself. People like me are, you said controversial, Steve. Others would say celebrated. Some would say notorious. And Sometimes it's nice to have an opportunity to talk about, give your own side of the story. And I think I've been quite honest about the ups and downs that I've had in my political life, to explain, where I went wrong in my political career, as well as what I did to fight back against some pretty difficult setbacks, which I hope will be an inspiration for others if they receive similar knocks in their professional lives.
Marianne Seacart in The Independent said the book wished as though you wished to unburden yourself of years of pent-up loathing for Brown and a cold contempt for Mandelson's puppet act. I'm quoting her. I have to admit I found myself nodding vigorously in agreement throughout.
Well, I didn't take the opportunity of offloading my views about Marianne Seacart because I don't think she matters very much as a political commentator and columnist. But what I wanted to do, what I really wanted to do, was not to settle scores, not to get my own back. That's pretty boring, I think, for people. I also didn't feel in that mood when I was writing the book. I don't feel that I have scores to settle as such. And I think that when you read it, you'll find an honest, a balanced and a rounded picture of both Tony Blair and Gordon Brown. People can make up their own minds about the account I give of both of them, not least because I have tried, where possible, to allow them to speak for themselves and their actions using their own words. Obviously, I haven't used all the words they uttered to me over the years. That would be an encyclopedic book. It also wouldn't be fair to them. But, where I have described them or attributed motives or described their actions, particularly in that interrelationship between the three of us, which was a complicated relationship between these three musketeers, I've tried to use their words where possible. So, as I say, I'm not offloading myself of any sort of sense of grievance. I have been generous to them because I think they were two very formidable politicians. Tony Blair, the first man, Gordon Brown, the second man, and me, modestly, the third man. But that's for others to judge when they read it.
But I mean, have you had any feedback from either Brown or Blair, or indeed, I mean, the book talks about all sorts of people.
I'd say I've had a bit of feedback from Blair and Brown.
Being?
Look, this is, people are honest between friends. And I think that, I tell you what I think about in the case of both of them, and it goes for a lot of other people as well, and it goes for some of the reviews that were written. These were not sort of judgments made or reviews written in most cases as a result of people reading the book so much as reading the serialization of the book in the Times. Now, obviously I knew what I was doing when I signed a contract that allowed the Times to serialize the book. But even I, with all my sort of media savvy and awareness, perhaps didn't quite expect the sort of surgical lifting of and sewing together, re-sewing together of 15,000 words out of a book of 200,000. And of course, it's inevitably going to be somewhat more selective, sensational, and dare I use the term sexed up, than perhaps you would glean from reading the book as a whole. So I'm not an innocent. I knew what to expect from the serialization, but it has struck me hugely that when people have read it, as many people did over the summer, they came back and started sending me emails and text messages, and indeed letters, of a quite a different kind from the initial reaction I had to the serialization.
Let's just turn to perhaps some of the wider questions. Is it your view that successful governments are a matter of big personalities?
Yes, I think big personalities are important in politics as they are in leading any organization. I think that big personalities are necessary to lead big organizations and big businesses. When you're right up there sort of taking everything, I mean, all the flak, all the pressure, you're also, you know, maintaining that even keel for yourself and your team and giving leadership and inspiration to people, you do indeed need a big personality. But to be a successful government, you need two or three other ingredients as well. First of all, you have to have a clear idea and a clear idea worked out in advance of what you're going to do in government. We sort of had that before 1997, but I think that we did not prepare in sufficient depth across the range of policies in the way that, you know, we should have done in order to hit the ground running in 97. I mean, sort of to be fair to us, Tony was elected in 94, very suddenly, with John Smith's death. We knew the election was going to come probably in 96, but then with what was happening to John Major's government, I mean, it was disintegrating, if you remember. I don't blame them. In the end, we weren't surprised that they went for the full length to 1997, but we had to prepare for an election in 96. So we had sort of like 15 months, and during that time, our view was that we had to make some pretty major sort of surgical changes to some of our policies. We had to put in place the planks of the sort of New Labour beliefs and outlook in respect of the economy, our attitude to markets, to the important principle of fiscal responsibility, changes to our views about spending and taxation as well, to the trade unions, to crime, to defence, education. I mean, there was a colossal across the range change of stance, attitude, which showed, I think, that our instincts as New Labour were different from those of what had gone before, certainly in the 80s under Michael Foot, to an extent different too from both Neil Kinnock and John Smith, who were the subsequent leaders. Now, in that sense, we made change right across the surface, as well as some important emblematic changes like rewriting the party's constitution and doing away with the pro-nationalisation clause, part four, clause four of our constitution. In other areas, I wish we'd had the time to have gone into greater depth in policy. For example, in respect of public services, we needed to have thought through earlier on some of the changes that we subsequently made in bringing about the change in sort of balance of priority, emphasis in the provision of our public services. We wanted to change those public services and how they were delivered and organized, not just to invest vast sort of sums of public investment in these services to bring about that sort of catch-up spending in our public services, but we wanted to change how they were organised and delivered too, putting the emphasis on, you know, the consumer of these services rather than producer interests, which in our view had dominated too much in the past. So it took us a bit of time once we were in government to work through these changes, many of which came, you know, in the second term. Had we done more before the first term, we could have started them early. And if I were to, I suppose, record one observation about the new coalition government in Britain, whether you approve or disapprove of what they're doing, they are getting their changes and their reforms in early. With what consequences, we can speculate, and we will have different views probably about what the consequences might be. But I think they're right to make these changes earlier on. I wish we had done so too.
You know that famous thing that Harold Macmillan always said when asked, you know, what are the great problems of government, and said, you know, events, dear boy, events. Yeah. Is that your experience of government, that you're just propelled by events knocking you from one side to the other of the room?
Well, you try not to be sort of buffeted from pillar to post by events, but they are just as Harold Macmillan described them, you know, the sort of tales of the unexpected. And these things that come and hit you are oftentimes containing small grains of truth, which are then magnified, you know, by, you know, our friends in the media doing their professional job in exaggerating everything, stretching the truth, attributing the worst possible motives to people, and exaggerating the consequences as well. But anyway, that's, you know, life in politics. And you know, you can't. There's no point in sitting around complaining about the weather. The weather is what it is. What you have to do is two things. One, whilst all the events are happening around you and you're dealing with them, you need to make sure that the team, your ministers, your officials, remain focused on their day jobs and what they're doing in order to ring the policy changes that you've committed yourself to. So don't be so sort of pushed off course that, you know, that you're sort of unbalanced and you're so sort of taken up with dealing with the media firefighting that you, as I say, you take your eye off, you know, what you're meant to be doing in your day job in your different departments. But also, and this is something that we learned, when events hit you, it's a curious thing to say, but oftentimes in government, what you forget to do is to check and establish the facts of what everyone is talking about. You almost accept the interpretation of events and the slant that is put on events by the media, you know, before you actually sit down and say, no, hold on, draw breath, we're going to actually work out what exactly happened, and then we're going to put the facts to you. Now, why is it difficult to do this? It's difficult to do it partly because you're taken by surprise, and the bigger the event, the more sort of winded you are, in a sense, in government. But also, we live in a completely different media age from that that Harold Macmillan had to take on. I mean, there was a guy talking about events, dear boy, events. And, you know, he could be literally away for a fortnight visiting Africa, Asia, or wherever, you know, before he actually came back to deal with them. Now, in this day and age, with the sort of 24-hour, 7-day-a-week, very, very pressing sort of news cycle being what it is, you barely have time to answer and to give a response to the media in sort of 20 minutes, let alone 2 weeks. It's a very, very different set of conditions in which you're working. Nonetheless, I always said to people, please, when something hits you, you know, if in doubt, say nout, because if you open your mouth too soon, you can only make matters worse and create confusion, as I found when I was forced to resign the second time. But because of the pressure of the media, having been in doubt and said nout, remember that you can't say nout for very long. And that was my maxim.
And I was, in fact, going to ask you something about this, because isn't there a kind of irony here, as you say, because of the state of communications, ministers, people who lead governments are much more immediately in touch with events, but aren't they also...
They're more immediately exposed to them, Steve. I mean,
exposed.
I mean, Look, Harold Macmillan or even Harold Wilson, wasn't sort of chased the moment they set foot outside the door by a dozen TV crews and microphones being thrust under there. I mean, there was a distance, there was a separateness of politics and politicians from the media in those days, which there isn't really now. I mean, I know that, if you want to go duck out through the back door and jump into the car and speed out of the back gate, I mean, you can, but nowadays, you know, there'll be more cameras waiting for you waiting for you outside the back door as there are in the front. I mean, you just can't evade or elude the media. You have to sort of, you know, face up to these things. As I say, under much greater pressure and at a much greater speed than we've ever had to do before in politics.
And does that result in politicians, ministers being more accountable?
Yes, on a good day. It also results in them making mistakes. You know, when I left the government, when I euphemistically resigned from the government the second time, I was forced out, actually, not because of what I did, but because of the confusion that was created and reported to the media by different accounts of what had happened. And as the sort of accounts of what had happened changed from one day to the next, an enormous elephant trap opened up in front of me into which I fell, or was pushed, depending on your point of view, because the media concluded that because they'd been given different versions, the only explanation for this must be because I was lying. Well, in fact, I hadn't lied, and I wasn't responsible for giving all the versions of the truth that they received.
But why didn't you brazen it out and just...
Because I wasn't allowed to. I wasn't allowed to. And I wasn't allowed to, first of all, because the facts weren't established. Secondly, because, as I sort of teetered on the edge of this elephant trap, you know, I was sort of gently sort of shoved towards it. And thirdly, because we were in election year and people wanted this all closed down quickly. Now, as it happens, an official inquiry was then set up under Sir Anthony Hammond, who reported, you know, whatever it was, 8 weeks later, and I was duly cleared. But by that time, I'd gone. I'd sort of disappeared into the elephant trap.
Let's just talk very briefly about the last election, because you had a central role in Labour's campaign. But, you know, just between ourselves, after 13 years, wasn't it inevitable that it was going to be practically impossible to carry on in government?
It was not inevitable that we continue, but it was also a tough climb up that sort of sheer cliff of a fourth election victory. By and large, governments don't have fourth terms. They do at the most 12, 13 years, and that's it. The Conservatives won a fourth election victory in 1992, the only time, I think, since the Second World War, partly because they sort of made the change. They jettisoned Maggie and put in John Major, and nobody had time to discover what John Major was like before the election was called. I'm not saying that he was a sort of bad guy, but, I mean, he had a party that was deeply divided, between sort of Thatcherites and non-Thatcherites, pro-Europeans, anti-Europeans, and his party basically sort of tore him apart for the next, 5 years. I think if the public had knew what sort of government they were re-electing, I think they would have thought twice. But I'm going to be honest with you too. People were unsure about whether they wanted Labour in 1992. We were still too akin to a Labour Party, a rather divided, rather trade union dominated, rather too tax and spend Labour Party for the public's tastes. I mean, they felt that sort of our instincts as a party were still governed too much by what the party wanted rather than what the voters wanted to elect in a government. They were unsure about our leader, Neil Kinnock, who they had seen very bravely, in my view, very courageously fighting back against the militant and the hard left in the 1980s, but were unsure nonetheless whether he would make, you know, such a good prime minister as he had been leader of the Labour Party when he was trying to sort out the Labour Party. So that's, look, if I have one insight from writing this book and looking back over 25 years of politics, that insight would be, and a pretty consistent insight it is too, that if you want to be elected in politics, you have to have three things in pretty clear, perfect alignment. One is your instincts, which need to be, as I say, in accordance with what the public wants rather than what the party wants to hear. Your instincts about what the country needs, what it wants, and what the public feel they want to vote for. Secondly, you have to have policies which correspond to your instincts so that there's no gap or division between the two. There's no point in saying one thing and then making an offer of policies which don't support what you say you're about. And thirdly, you need good presentation. You need to communicate well. And when I became director of campaigns and communications of the Labour Party at the tender age of 32 in 1985, and sort of brought about this sort of revolution in our communications, it was at a time when many, probably most in the Labour Party, thought that selling yourself using, you know, classy communications or good advertising was somehow impure, was sort of something sort of rather unsocialist about it. You remember those days, Steve. And, you know, it's no good. You know, you've got to have these three things together and properly aligned. And we didn't in 1987, which was the first election that I ran for the Labour Party. It was a great election campaign. Red roses and everything. We were a sort of shiny new car, but we hadn't actually re-engineered the car. And it was a very glitzy, glossy campaign, described at the time, I remember, by Private Eye as Labour's brilliant election defeat. Because the campaign was so great, it was just a shame about the result. 92, we hadn't got these things in perfect alignment either. We actually only got our act together and all these ducks in a row seriously in 97. And then by 2010, frankly, we had lost our perfect alignment. We weren't quite the same, you know, new Labour instincts, policies and presentation in 2010 that we had been in 1997.
I am going to open this up in a minute, but I want to take the opportunity of you being here to be slightly parochial and just ask you, when you were European Trade Commissioner, just give us a flavour of what it was like negotiating with the Chinese, because that actually took up a lot of your time.
Oh, it was without doubt the most time-consuming thing I had to do. I mean, I was confronted with this baptism of fire. I was appointed in... And I took up my job in November 2004. I'd been appointed early in July. And I arrived in Brussels. And I think it was probably the first or the second meeting I had with my director general officials. And they said, Commissioner, the first thing you've got to know is that on January the 1st, in 2 months' time, the multi-fiber agreement at long last is going to cease to exist. And I sort of blinked and thought, multi-fiber agreement, yeah, it will come to me. This means, Commissioner, that there's going to be free trade in textiles. And of course, you know, although it's taken 10 years to negotiate and implement, and it's gone in stages, and finally the markets are all going to be freed up, we're going to have to reimpose unilaterally new tariffs and restrictions to stop this trade. Otherwise, we're going to be buried under an avalanche of Chinese textile goods, and we just can't take it. I said, but hold on a moment. You've just told me that we've taken 10 years to negotiate and implement the ending of this, these restrictions and tariffs on trade in textiles. How can we just reimpose them? He said, oh, Commissioner, he said, you don't understand.
Yes, Minister moment.
You don't understand. I don't think anyone expects there to be literally free trade. And I said, well, I think the Chinese probably expect there to be free trade. After all, that's what they entered the WTO for, amongst other things, because they have certain expectations and, frankly, certain entitlements. You know, that's what they've signed up to the WTO for. And I'm sorry, I don't think I can do this. And they looked at me with a sort of mixture of sort of pity and sort of perplexity. And they said, well, Commissioner, we'll come back to this. And indeed, they did come back to it 2 weeks later. And they put before me the regulations to sign, which would indeed reintroduce the tariffs and the restrictions on January the 1st. I said, no, I'm not. I'm sorry. I'm not going to do this. I think there will be a huge revolt from the Chinese if we do that. And they said, well, Commissioner, if you don't do it, there will be a huge backlash in Europe, you know, in France and Italy and Portugal and other countries where there are major textile producers, and they're all going to be put out of their jobs. I said, okay, I see the point, but I'm going to go to the Chinese and I'm going to ask them whether they would, in all the circumstances, agree to a little further period of phasing in so that they have in due course literally the free trade they're entitled to, but that we just manage the situation in Europe so that we don't provoke a backlash against free trade. And they looked again at me in this sort of pitying way. Said, Commissioner, you're going to go and ask the Chinese whether they will agree to a sort of a phasing in, a postponement. You don't understand these people, Commissioner. They're not going to agree to anything. You're going to have to impose this. To cut a long story short, it took me 3 more months, many phone calls, a couple of meetings with Bo Xilai, who eventually agreed that I should come to Shanghai and negotiate such a voluntary agreement. And we did. In 14 categories of textiles, we agreed a further 2-year grace period in which we would progressively phase in rather than have all this done straight away. And it was the first lesson I learned that if you are reasonable and if you offer something in return, you can oftentimes get something back from Chinese negotiators and your counterparts, but that both sides have to win. If both sides don't win, then Chinese, not unreasonably, will use their entitlements and their force behind them in order to get their way. And ever since, I have preferred to negotiate voluntarily rather than to impose unilaterally. And I think that has got us further in Europe than we would otherwise have got. I think it's created a sound, longer-term relationship between the EU and China than we would otherwise have had. And I think it's also served the interests of free trade and therefore the interests of Europe better in the long term than if we tried to maintain restrictions and tariffs and obstacles to trade, which I think it would be better to change and adjust and meet the pressures of free trade than try to sort of sort of stand there Canute-like and stop the way, try to stop the waves come in, and in the end probably or certainly fail to do so.
But no bruises. I mean, the reason I ask you that is I have spoke to other people who've negotiated with Chinese officials who say they feel they almost come out with bandages on.
Look, it wasn't a picnic, nor was it a cakewalk, nor was it a stroll through the park. I remember in the case of that negotiation in Shanghai, for example, on textiles, that I arrived tired, barely prepared and jet-lagged in Shanghai. I was given an hour and a half to wash and change before going into this negotiation in the state guest house. I encountered Bo Jilai with what must have been approaching something in the region of 150 to 200 serried ranks of officials sitting beside him and behind him. I had sort of six men and a dog, if I remember. He sat me down straight away. We started the negotiation without any, you know, warming up. He had a formidable, I don't know what she was. She was sort of head of protocol, maitre d', bullier in chief. She's a wonderful woman who looked at me, and every time, I sort of appeared to be raising sort of European interest or some plea for slightly fairer treatment, I would sort of get this look thrown at me by the head of protocol, who every time we broke, you know, for a slight pause or consultation, she would come round to me. She said, "You are acting extremely unreasonably. This is most unfair to my minister. My minister has come here, he's got his reputation to defend, and you're not making things at all easy for him. I suggest you are much more compromising." Sat down, we started again, we paused again, and I noticed she was giving out sort of mega vitamin C tablets, you know, to the Chinese side. And I said, "Do you think we could..." "Certainly not," she said. Went on for another 2 hours, paused again, and she brought out some tea and sandwiches for the Chinese side. She said, "You'll have a plate of biscuits," she said. "One plate of biscuits," she said. And so this went on. So, yes, I mean, it wasn't easy, and we went on overnight, and I think we, sometime during the next morning or so, I can barely remember, we reached an agreement. And it was sort of bruising, but we nonetheless reached an agreement, and we parted friends. And we had lots of difficult encounters after that, both with Bo Jilai and his successor Chen Denming. But what I felt about them is that they always wanted to find some sort of solution. It might not be a solution entirely, know, to my liking, and not one that necessarily that would be easy for me to sell when I got home, but nonetheless they wanted an agreement, and that wasn't always the case with the countries I negotiated in on trade as trade commissioner.
I'm going to ask you one more question then, throw it open, but I mean, do you miss this? Do you miss being a minister? Do you miss having a job where you're running a big department, etc.?
Well, I know I meant to say and put on a very brave face and pretend that, you know, I'm fine, I'm full of confidence about the future, that I've made the adjustment really well, that I'm a grown-up and that I understand, you know, the facts of political life, and, you know, I'm looking forward to the next challenge. But I'm afraid I don't really feel like that. No, I miss it hugely. Yeah, I do. Actually, I wish I was trade commissioner again. I wish I could sort of wave a magic wand, turn the clock back, go back to Brussels and take up where I left off when I returned to the British government. Not because I don't like being in the British government. Of course I do, and I like serving my country, and I would like in some way an opportunity to do so again. But trade had its own particular fascination and complexity. and having been sort of booted out by the British voters, it's a shame that I can't go back to where I was, but I can't, and that's life. So I'm going to have to find something else to do. Useful, I hope.
Okay, let me just open this up. Is there... Can you just...
You've got a loud voice, but here's the microphone. Come on.
Is currently or ever will be an incentive for those of us who left to go back?
I can't promise you the same tax rates as you get here in Hong Kong. I think it will be some time before we're ever in a position to introduce those. But should you come back, and you're very welcome, I'd like to see you. Back in Blighty, you will find a country that is at ease with itself, isn't scarred by sort of social divisions, is a pleasant enough place to live in, which as a result of 13 years of Labour government has better education and health and other public services for the investments and reforms we made. Hopefully not too much wanton damage will be inflicted on them by the new coalition government. You will have crime lower than it was when we came to office in 1997. You will have an economy that has been blown off course and has had a hell of a hole created in its GDP, but nonetheless is fundamentally, I believe, sound and able to climb back to its previous strength, and you will enjoy greater social and individual rights in Britain than you did before when we came to office. Now, all of those things, or none of them, may be enough for you to come back. But should you decide to do so, I think you will find a country that, you know, with the rule of law, without corruption, I'm not saying that you have that here, obviously, but many other attributes of a strong democracy, a wonderful free press, that you will enjoy living in and amongst, actually. Come back.
We have a question here. I'm sorry, I should have reminded you just to identify yourself before asking.
I'm Robin Weir from China Business Law Journal. Can you explain to us what was going through your mind as the Labour Party elected Ed Miliband as its leader?
I thought that, as I have written in the book, that that era, that phase of New Labour, which was associated with Tony and Gordon and myself, came to an end on May the 6th, and that it is now time for a new era, a new phase of New Labour, that rather than slam the door on New Labour and in the faces of those millions of our fellow voters who voted for our party because we were New Labour, it would be better to reshape, remould, take New Labour forward in some way rather than pronounce its death, but that in Ed Miliband we have an intelligent, able leader who's young, certainly yes, but I think who has shown by the good start that he has made that he has the potential to deliver success for the Labour Party, and I for one, I'm going to give him the space and the opportunity to create that success. I don't think that it's for people like me. I mean, if people want to, you know, use my know-how or experience to draw on that, fine. But it's not for me to sort of hover over people and sort of tell people how to do things. It's for the new generation to decide that, and that's, I really feel that.
Sorry, I think this question here first and then...
Thank you. My name's Tom Engle. I was a special advisor, Peter, in the middle period of the Labour government. And it often felt...
Who to?
To David Blunkett. And it often felt looking up at the top ministerial team as if it was we were watching our parents squabbling and our grandparents squabbling and our aunts and uncles squabbling. And yet looking on from afar at the later years of the government, it seemed as if there were a number of relationships being mended with your own return to government, with Alistair Campbell's, whatever it was. And I just wondered if you could reflect sort of personally on some of the lessons learned about how, you know, senior figures under pressure of the sort that you said managed to get along with one another.
Look, I think they got along better, a heck of a lot better than it sometimes appeared, but not as well consistently as they should have done and as they had a responsibility to the government and the party in the country to do. You have strong personalities at the top of a government. You know, in my grandfather's time, he was Deputy Prime Minister to Attlee, Herbert Morrison, in the post-war government. All those guys at their Attlee and Bevin and Bevan and Morrison and, you know, they didn't exactly love each other. You know, Ernie Bevin said of my grandfather that some people observe that, you know, Herbert is his own worst enemy, but I can assure you, not while I'm alive, Ernie Bevin said. And, you know, people, look at Mrs. Thatcher's government at the end of the 1980s. I mean, her government, her cabinet literally broke up. Michael Heseltine walked out of it. Nigel Lawson resigned as Chancellor. Geoffrey Howe then resigned as Deputy Prime Minister. And then finally she was thrown out. I mean, it was, but only after she had lost the top two or three people in her administration. Now, I'm glad to say that, you know, Tony's government, our government, never reached that sorry state. Towards the end, it's true. I mean, people say, why did I leave Brussels? Why did I come back and serve in a government and serve a prime minister who in some respects had been pretty difficult and pretty unkind towards me because he saw me as backing Blair and propping Blair up and whatever. And I explain all this and I go through in some, you know, with some pretty graphic description and account in my book, as I hope that you will see. But I suppose one of the reasons I came back, it wasn't the main reason, but one of the main reasons I wanted to come back is that I wanted to repair that rift or rupture that occurred. I wanted to close that chapter. I wanted to put it behind me and us. And I think we did, to everyone's benefit. But the truth is, I wish that the difficult relations had never grown in the first place. We were a strong government nonetheless, but we would have been an even stronger government had we kept these under control.
We have a question here. Sorry, no, here. And then.
My name is Paul Mottram. I work in marketing. I wanted to ask, if John Smith had not died when he did, do you think that Labour would have won that election, and what kind of government would have ensued?
Well, I think we would, because I think by 1997 the Conservatives had become almost literally unre-electable. I mean, if you just remember what was going on, I mean, there was a good core of John Major's cabinet who were openly defiant of him and seeking to oppose him. He, on one famous occasion when he thought he wasn't being recorded, described them as the bastards in the cabinet. The government had just had sort of almost ground to a halt by the time we reached 1997. So I think they were unre-electable, but what I do believe is that we wouldn't have been elected as a Labour administration with the same majority, with the same sort of mandate, for the same sort of policies that were contained in our manifesto. And secondly, I think that it would have been difficult to sustain us in office over three terms. I think that in all probability, on balance, how can I put it, we would have run out of steam earlier. But, you know, that's my completely hypothetical look backwards, if you can look backwards hypothetically.
Okay, this question here.
I'd like to ask you about environmental policies and why they seem to slip when a government is in power and jobs and the economy seem to be more pressing than climate.
God, is that true though, really?
I think so. And even with this present Conservative government, they had the slogan, vote blue, get green or something.
Yeah.
And now it seems to be slipping. And, you know, if you take some of the more...
But you know why that is, don't you?
You know,
they're Tories and they never really believed in it in the first place. Okay. Let me give you a serious answer.
Can I give a follow-on, okay, which is okay, linked? Which is, and then we had the first Green MP elected in this last election. Mm. So I'm wondering if you think there's a possibility that Green politics, in a formal political party sense, can become a significant player in British politics. More than a minority party and possibly even a significant party.
We haven't seen it in Britain as other continental European countries have. I mean, the emergence of, you know, a Green vote and the Green Party, we haven't seen that in Britain. The last time the Greens came to the fore in British politics was, if I remember rightly, in the European elections in 1989. They subsided pretty quickly after that. They didn't show great staying power. But I would take issue with you in what you said at the beginning. I felt that we were stronger on the environment, on certainly on climate change, towards the end of our time in government than we had been at the beginning of the 13 years. I don't remember a great green plank in our manifesto in 1997, to be frank. I don't remember people talking about climate change in 1997. By the end of our time in office, it had become a very dominant issue and a very important set of policies. We introduced legislation on climate change, which was more progressive and more advanced than I believe any other European country. We had led in Europe to put in place a set of commitments that were pretty uncompromising and potentially extremely costly, I hasten to add. Now, has that green agenda just slipped away through lack of interest? I don't believe so, and I don't think it will be the case actually for this government either. But there are priorities in politics, and at a time when we are fighting to restore our economy, to repair our national finances and to draw down the deficit that we incurred in fighting back against the financial crisis, I think it's understandable that a government places its priorities there than elsewhere. That doesn't have to mean at the expense of green priorities, just to use that shorthand. I think it's something that this government could and should come back to later on. I assume the Liberal Democrats will use their influence in the government, such as it is, to try and sort of restore the green agenda, the environmental agenda. They should do. I hope they will. They'll certainly have my support, and I think the support of my party if they do that.
Okay, we have a question here. Question here. Great. The mic's on its way.
Can I have absolutely no idea of the time, because my watch says it's 5.
I'm
on English time, so I have no idea what the time is.
We've got, roughly speaking, about another 5 minutes.
5 minutes?
Yeah.
Okay, because then you've got to throw me out. Okay, I've got to.
My name is Carl Tong. I'm a businessman. There's a very interesting report in the Financial Times today about analyzing the trade imbalance in the world. What, in your view, are the chances of the American government's efforts to try and put a limit on trade surpluses, especially on China?
I don't think they're going to succeed in doing so at this G20. I think that they are in a difficult position in demanding it because, you know, everyone's policies have byproducts or unintended consequences that in one way or another are contributing to these imbalances, even American policies. I'm not attaching a value judgment to them. I'm not saying they're right or wrong. But I think that it's going to be harder to win agreement simply in those terms when there are differences of interest that exist not only in China and other of the sort of emerging or re-emerging economies, but differences of interest and opinion that exist within the original G8 as well. I mean, look at the remarks made by the German finance minister about the US measures that have been introduced to do with their money supply, their quantitative easing. Now, let me give you a broader answer, though, to your question. In my view, and I think about this a great deal, and I've just been in China, and I have a lot to do with other members of the G20. In my view, the aims of the United States, the interests of other members of the G20, and the five-year plan of China are compatible. I think they basically reinforce each other. I think everyone needs and would seek that rebalancing that you've described. I think that people, both China and its external partners, would like to see a rebalancing of the Chinese economy so that it's less dependent on export growth and draws more on a greater level of demand of consumption within the Chinese economy. But for that to happen, you know, savings have to be less prioritized by the Chinese people and consumption more emphasized. China needs to evolve into an economic model that depends less on cheap labor and cheap capital and more on more dynamic markets and private enterprise and business and less on state-owned enterprises and state activity in the economy. There are all sorts of changes, in other words, and adjustments and rebalancing that need to take place in all our economies, but they take time. And I think that to expect China to sort of make these sort of adjustments in a way that they become sort of lurches in policy is not only impractical, I think it could also be dangerous because it could produce the sorts of unintended consequences that we've seen in big policy lurches in other economies, and because China, economically, socially, is a very big, complex country and economy. It knows it has to face almost daunting challenges and changes that it's got to undertake, and these are not going to happen quickly, and they're certainly not going to happen overnight. So, I mean, I apologize for the platitude, but we have to work together to bring about these changes. We have to recognize and understand that China is not just a market, it's also a society. And it's a society that needs to bring about changes in how people live and work and where they live and work, what they save, or how much they can over time rely on welfare and other public services within that country that will bring changes to the economy in their wake as well. But as I say, these are going to evolve over time, not be produced overnight, and not at the drop of a communique after one summit or another.
I'm going to try just squeeze another two in.
And
very
I'll be
quickly.
Shorter.
Neil Fraser from the South China Morning Post. Some people might have seen the whole New Labour project as a rebranding exercise more than anything very substantive, and you hinted towards that earlier. I'd like to ask you, what are your political beliefs and your political philosophy and your political instincts, and have they changed from the time you entered politics and where you are now?
Well, it was a rebranding exercise, but if it had only been that, it wouldn't have been successful, for the reason that I said. Unless your instincts genuinely as a party and your policies are in alignment with your presentation and your communications and your branding, then the public are pretty quickly going to sniff out that there's something wrong and hollow about this, and they're not going to vote for it. So we had to make changes that were genuine and which were sincere, which accepted the precepts or principles of a market economy that prioritized a business and enterprise, because that's where employment is created, that was sufficiently competitive to make our way in a very tough global economy, but which we also were able to give people the confidence to embrace and to changes in their lives and in their employment, because we were social democrats. We believe in a sort of social democratic ethos in how society should be run, and that is with a government that doesn't leave people to sink or swim as they become winners or losers in a market economy, but are helped both to succeed and to be winners, helped when they reach different points in their lives when they need most help from the state, and where they can look to an education system and university places and skill raising and training programs that enable people to have the greatest opportunity in their lives and fulfill the potential that they have to make the most of their lives. Now, that is what I believe in. That is what I am about. I am, in a sense, a believer in liberal economics, but within a framework of appropriate government or state activity or intervention that makes people winners rather than losers. That's what I believe in.
Okay, Sandip. Sorry, I know there's a lot of questions, but...
One last.
Well, thanks very much, Peter. I recently left journalism after 20 years in the profession for public relations. I just wondered, as a spin doctor of some repute, what top tips you have for a novice like me as I start to deal with the media on the other side.
My advice to you in relation to journalists is to take them into your confidence, but don't necessarily trust them. Talk to them as friends, but never lower your guard. Okay? That's free gratis.
Well, I have one final pleasant duty. Don't move. The FCC traditionally burdens its visitors with a gift. This is a gift that will keep you dry. As you're going back to London, I would like to thank you very much indeed. It's been a great pleasure. And Peter Mandelson, as I said, had kindly agreed to stay behind to sign some more books, so we'll do that at the back.
I mean, that's if you want to discover the rest of the truth. On top of what I've said, you'll now have to buy the book.